Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. It's been an autumn filled with new dramas about vampires, and Sci-Fi has one of the most unique running Wednesday nights. Title, Reginald the Vampire. Showrunner, Emmy nominee from Twin Peaks, Harley Payton, and he'll join me next in an internet radio exclusive. One of public television's longest-running programs is making a major anniversary this fall. Believe it or not, great performances has engaged viewers with the performing arts for half a century, and we will celebrate with executive producer David Horn around the top of the next hour. Also ahead, Disney's latest Star Wars series moves forward, a new Netflix franchise, Jimmy Kimmel is Oscar-bound again, and the return of our classic trivia question. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum, simulcasting live from New York on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, and TuneIn Radio. I present on the iHeartRadio Podcast Network, Spotify, iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and other leading podcast destinations. This just in, tomorrow will be televised. Thank you all for joining us on this day before Election Day 2022. 75 degrees here in the Big Apple on a beautiful Monday afternoon. I hope you all set those clocks back an hour so you got that extra hour of sleep on Sunday morning. We got a good one for you. Two marvelous guests, and we invite you to be part of the program. It's so simple. Pick up the phone and dial in. This is the number you use, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. The number is good anyway. You're catching us across the country or around the world here on Blog Talk Radio, Speaker, or TuneIn Radio. Don't forget, we got the chat room for you as well, so use it. It's SimonApple04 by name. You will find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. And while the promo is on the air, you can connect others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon, your Blog Talk Radio, Speaker, TuneIn screen. Follow the instructions. Other people live with you. Emmy nominee from Twin Peaks, Harley Payton, joins us live from Bainbridge Island, Washington State, after these news notes. Fans of Disney Plus Star Wars have a reason to cheer this Monday afternoon. Production gets underway on Great Britain on the latest Star Wars series, The Acolyte. It's the long-planned High Republic saga from Russian Doll overseer Leslie Headland, who will direct the first episode. The cast includes Amanda Steinberg, Squid Game Emmy winner Ling Junjie, and Carrie Ann Moss of The Matrix fame. Ryan Murphy will turn his monster miniseries from a one-shot Jeffrey Dahmer docudrama to an ongoing Netflix franchise. Two more monster installments will be undertaken by Murphy and Netflix, each depicting a person impacting society. And that's not all the big news Netflix brought to Murphy this morning. The Watcher, becoming a cultural touchpoint for its thriller approach to the real estate world, will get a second season on Netflix, expected late 2023 or 2024. And ABC didn't wait long to select its Academy Awards host next March. Jimmy Kimmel will get his third Oscar host gig, the first two happening in back-to-back years, 2017 and 2018. Kimmel's reply via a press release, and we quote, "Being invited to host the Oscars for a third time is either a great honor or a trap. Either way, I am grateful to the Academy for asking me so quickly after everyone good said no." The Academy Awards turn 95 on ABC March 12th, live from Dolby Theater at Ovation Hollywood. We will have news, no quickies at the bottom of the hour, and I have some thoughts about what Jimmy Kimmel just said in his press release about the Oscars, the last thing he said in our second half hour. So for the moment, that is news notes for today. On a Sunday night in April 1990, ABC unleashed a phenomenon known as Twin Peaks that nobody had ever seen before. You could say it was the forerunner of really weird television. And in lickety-split time, it became a phenomenon over its year and a half on that network, from April 1990 to June 1991. Everyone was talking about the amazing cast, the incredible plots put together by people like David Lynch and Mark Frost, the unusual directing approaches, Angelo Badalamenti's music, and, of course, all those crazy, crazy characters led by that big question, who killed Laura Palmer? My first guest today won an Emmy nomination for writing on both seasons of the original Twin Peaks, and he's gone on to have even more great success. The latest is right now being part of Sci-Fi's Wednesday night schedule, 10 p.m. East Pacific time, as the executive producer and showrunner of the new series, Reginald the Vampire. Joining us live in an internet exclusive from Bainbridge Island, Washington, off Seattle, Harley Payton. Harley, it's a pleasure to have you on.
No, Simon, thanks for having me on, and thanks for updating me with the latest news. I did not know Kimmel was hosting the Oscars, but now I do.
It's great to get that news out to you. What's it like for you be part of television as part of this vampire phenomenon that's going on this fall with Interview with a Vampire, your series, Vampire Camp from Julie Fleck, Let the Right One In on Showtime? I mean, It's like the phenomenon, the subject du jour this fall.
Yeah, it's a subject matter in an area that I've always loved. Buffy the Vampire Slayer is probably one of my top five shows. But I watched, you know, all the vampire shows between there. I watched Vampire Diaries twice, once by myself, once with my daughter. So it's an area that I've always wanted to work in, a genre that I've always wanted to work in, because I think there's so many interesting questions that kind of arise from it for a writer to kind of tackle. And this book, which is originally called Fat Vampire, came across my desk, so to speak, and that was how we got it to where it is today. And it was just a wonderful opportunity to kind of take on a different kind of vampire story, because I think the main character, Reginald, is likely unlike most other vampires you're going to see on television.
He comes across, Harley, based on the novels, by the way, by a writer named, a very good writer named Johnny Chuan, B. Chuan. He comes across as like a fish out of water. He's like trying to lead a normal vampire life, and he can't get like the girl he wants. He can't get like the life he wants. It sort of raises the opportunity for some wonderful dramedy possibilities.
Yeah, I mean, I think what was always very important is to take certain tropes, romantic comedy tropes, the kind of journey tropes that our hero's journey that he's going to take. And that was one of the fun things, is you can use the vampire world to subvert them. And so for us, it was really important to see how Reginald would deal with the impossible, and if it's possible, to become a better man while being a dead one. And so that was really the journey that we embarked upon from the very beginning, and Jacob Batalon was the perfect person for us to follow through that journey.
I want to get back to Jacob in a moment, but what kind of journey was it for you and your production team to take and adapt this novel and finally get on Sci-Fi this fall?
Well, it was thrilling. I mean, it's, and like every development story, it's a complicated one. We actually started out thinking it might be a half hour. I wrote a couple half hours just to see how it might work, because we'd already optioned the book. And then actually Todd Berger, one of our producers, said, look, you should go to Sci-Fi. They're looking for material like this. Genre with a sense of humor is sort of the headline, and that's something that we were trying to do. And so we brought it to Michael Slusian at Sci-Fi, who really pretty much bought it in the room. And that was one of those rare things and a wonderful thing for us. And they've been so supportive since that time. So I think we've been lucky to find the right home for Reginald, because finding the wrong one would have made things more difficult. But, you know, we had a very good launch that way. And then you produce the show and you're going to have your ups and downs and your difficulties, but it's been fairly smooth sailing, and you need to be lucky for that to happen, but we've been very lucky.
And when did Jacob Batalon, your star, enter the picture?
Well, as you can imagine, this was a cast contingent show. We had to find Reginald because everything sort of rotates around him. And I can't tell you how many actors we talked to. There was a couple who I thought were really good, and I was really pushing at one point. Grace Wu, who handles casting over there, is very tough, very picky, and completely brilliant. And she at one point said, you know who might be available is Jacob Batalon. And that's what I mean by luck. Is that we had the lucky break of she heard about that. We did a Zoom session with Jacob. He loved the script. He really related to it based on his own personal experiences in high school with bullying and body shaming. And so we just were an extraordinary moment where suddenly it's like, oh, my God, we've got Jacob Batalon. And I knew that he had great comic timing. I knew he was super funny from the Spider-Man movies. But what I didn't know is just what a wonderful dramatic actor he is. So that was one of those moments where I talk about luck. It was a real lucky break that just on that day, Grace happened to think about Jacob, and now he's Reginald.
And Reginald the Vampire you can now see on Sci-Fi Wednesday nights at 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific Time. We are talking to Emmy nominee from Twin Peaks, Harley Payton, who is the executive producer and showrunner of Reginald. And he is with us live from Bainbridge Island, Washington State, not far from Seattle, in an inter-radio exclusive this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised. Tom and I, I'm with you live from the other side of the U.S. of A. It's Nueva York, where it's 75 gorgeous degrees at the top of the hour. You have a question or comment for Harley? Don't be shy. Ring it in. Number you use, 646-652-2906, or use the chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Party on Tomorrow Be Televised. We'll meet a producer who has worked with the likes of David E. Kelley, who is trying to get her own series on television. The series is called Middlehood. The creator and producer is Michelle Palermo, and believe it or not, she's already made the first season through a Kickstarter campaign and through some work with SeriesFest, the Denver-based TV programming festival. Michelle Palermo from Middlehood, creator and producer of that series, looking for someone to take it home and for you to see. Right here, Friday, one of our special guests, on tomorrow and be televised. Harley, what's been the reaction from viewers so far to your series?
I think the reaction has been great. I mean, you go through a process where you're making it, you're not thinking about that. You just want to make the best show you can. And the first reaction that you're looking for is the reaction from the network. And everyone at Sci-Fi has been so great. They really do love this show. The people who promote the show have done some of the best work I've ever seen. And I worked on Chucky, so I know just how good they are at that. So that's the first hurdle. And then it's successive hurdles. It's the critics. And we got some very nice reviews, and that helped too. But the most important thing are the people who watch the show. And I think, generally speaking, we've had really great reactions. People love Reginald, love the world that he's traveling in, and also just love the kind of collection of characters that we've put together to kind of dot the kind of map of the show along the way. So the reaction's been great, and I'm really happy about it.
Yeah. Mr. Chucky himself, Don Mancini, was on our program several weeks ago, and one of the things we talked about was the fact that he wanted Chucky on television to sort of be more than just, you know, here's this doll that, like, stabs people and makes crazy jokes and curses and all that. He wanted to make it sort of a commentary on society, especially on people who are sort of the underrepresented in the world. And it sounds like both of you, both Don and you, are on the same wavelength, maybe because you worked on that series, that in this case, it's the lead character rather than the people around Chucky who are sort of, you know, the people who want, like, a better life than what they've got.
Yeah, and that was an important part of Johnny's book, and it was something that we wanted to kind of carry through as we did the series. And listen, it's subtext a lot. Sometimes it's text. But we wanted to deal with body shaming and body positivity and those issues that people have who are kind of fighting against impossible beauty standards that society creates, but also to go even more or kind of wider than that, no pun intended, and to talk about what it's like to try to find your best self. What does it take for you to kind of look inside and see what kind of abilities you have? And if they happen to be supernatural powers, so be it. If you have to die and become a vampire to be your best self, then, you know, so be it. And that was what we really wanted to play with all along. And for a lot of our characters, not just Reginald, we wanted to make sure that there was a road they traveled from episode 1 to episode 10 so that when we got to that kind of end point, they were different than they were when we first met them.
Because this series deals a lot with how people look, as you said, body shaping, body perfection, if you will, what kind of research was either done by you or your writers and your directors and Jacob to deal with the issue, to sort of really understand, get into the mindset, if you will, of people who are dealing with this subject?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think for me personally, a lot of it was when I was talking to writers, because a lot of writers would talk to me about their personal experiences and how long it took them to accept themselves and how their bodies didn't meet certain perfect kind of societal standards that had been set and what that journey was like. And for me, that was really important and a lot of lessons learned no matter who I was talking to. And as I said before, Jacob himself had dealt with that when he was in high school, that one of the reasons he really related to the two scripts was that he knew what it was like for people to look at you in a certain way based on how much you weighed or what the shape of your body was. So I think all the writers, some from their own personal experience, some through research, you know, books they could read, reaching out to various people in their lives, it was really important to us. And by the way, Joni Truant did a wonderful job in his book too, because that was something that he, you know, after all, the book was called Fat Vampire originally. That was something that he really wanted to deal with. And it was something that we stuck with throughout the first season, because it's really all about finding the best self inside you and not letting society determine who you were. And for Johnny, he did create this world of vampires who were sort of obsessed with beauty. And they're like the Met Gala red carpet come to life with fangs. And there was something sort of funny about that they had created this completely beautiful society that was just a little dim. And so the fact that Reginald, with his big brain, comes tumbling into that like a wrecking ball is really much of how we wanted to play the season.
How often did you ask Jacob to use his life, use his experiences, use his pain, if you will, to make the character more powerful, to make the character more relatable to people?
I mean, I think that's something that you do at the start. It's by the time we were, you know, episode 3 or 5 or 7, he was already fully immersed in that character, and he was calling upon so many different things from his life. And whether that's about the romance arc that he plays there, if the mistakes that his character makes, because he makes some pretty big ones, And so I think for Jacob, it was really a conversation at the beginning, and there was a lot of talk about it then in some of our early rehearsals, a short amount of rehearsal time before we started shooting, and we certainly talked about the character in great detail then. But at that point, it's like, okay, we're handing this to you now. Run with it. And if you need to make adjustments later, you make them. But in terms of Reginald, in terms of Jacob, he ran with it. And he was really our hero. I mean, this is someone who is shooting movies. They probably shoot 2 pages a day, maybe. We had 10-page days. And Jacob was on set for almost every one of those scenes. And there was a real concern, like, would he burn down over time? Would the production schedule be too onerous? And you know what? He was unbelievable, never tired. And it's a top-down kind of system when you're on set. And when number one in the call sheet has such a great attitude and is having so much fun, everybody else has fun too. And I owe Jacob a great deal for that because he really made my life a lot easier.
Yeah. Before we move on, Harley, why do you think all of a sudden this fall we are seeing all these vampire dramas, and they all seem to have their points of view? Interview with a Vampire on AMC, its point of view based on the Anne Rice novel and the previous movie. You have Julie Plec, who's done Vampire Diaries and so forth in the CW, and she's got Vampire Academy on Peacock. You have Let the Right One In with Academy Award nominee Damien Bashir on Showtime. It seems that why do you think we're getting all of these different approaches to the subject of vampires all of a sudden?
I mean, that's such a great question, and I'm not sure I have an answer. I mean, when you think about genre and you think about the various sort of monsters that are out there, whether you're talking about werewolves or zombies or, you know, or vampires, what seems to be the strongest genre that offers the most possibilities for writers to look at and deal with are vampires. And I think that's about living forever. I mean, one of the things we talk about in the show in our first season is how long does it take to forgive someone, right? If you're subsumed and kind of obsessed with vengeance, if you live forever, can you really continue to be that way, and do you change? And so I think the things that I loved about writing for vampires are what other writers are attracted to. It's that anything is possible, and that there's that odd circumstance, although in some cases apparently you can walk during the day if it's overcast. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is that I think for any writer it's a really rich text, and one of the favorite ones, and I think that's why you saw so many of them in the past. And as you point out, there was sort of a pause. And then all of a sudden, it's in the air, I guess, and people start wanting to do vampire shows again. And then suddenly we've got a bunch of them on the air, most of which I watch. I mean, it's something that I've always loved just as a viewer, and it was really great to have a chance to finally take it on as a showrunner.
You're hearing Harley Payton. He's the Emmy nominee from Twin Peaks, and he is now the executive producer and showrunner of Reginald the Vampire, the new series on Sci-Fi. It's running Wednesday nights at 10:10 Eastern and Pacific Time. Harley joins us live from Bainbridge Island, Washington State, not far from Seattle, this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised. In a moment, we'll talk Twin Peaks, and we'll also talk about what he did after Twin Peaks by reviving one of the great groundbreaking series of all time, Route 66, with one of its key creators, the brilliant executive producer, Herbert B. Leonard. It's a very interesting situation. We'll talk to you probably about that. And if you have a question or comment or many minutes with him, give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use the chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Coming up near the top of the hour, we're going to celebrate 50 years of great performances, one of the longest-running series in public television or any television history, with one of its only executive producers, David Horn. He will join me live from Long Island near the top of the hour. Harley, why did Twin Peaks do what it did?
Boy, what a question. I got to tell you, I think it's something that shouldn't have happened. I think ABC was in a position where they were willing to kind of take a big swing. And so they had this opportunity that was crafted, I think, by an agent, actually, who was representing both Mark and David. And he was always trying to get David to do television. And so they'd gone through a couple ideas and finally got the two of them together. But I've always felt that it was a miracle. I mean, and this probably in its favor, there was no internet really then. The fan base stuff was completely different. And when you think about what it was like when it was on the air, I mean, there was nothing like it. I remember having a bunch of friends over to watch the pilot when the season started, and most of them were television writers, some feature writers. And when it was over, they just kind of sat and looked at each other because they really didn't know what to make of it. And some of them were actually a little angry, I think. It's like, well, how come you got to do that? And so I don't think there'll ever be the time for something like that to happen again. But it happened at a time where television was hardly interrupted. There were a lot of good shows then. But Twin Peaks was so different. And, of course, the difference is in the partnership between David and Mark.
How did you get to be not only part of that writer's room with Lynch and Frost, but also get the Emmy status that you did, because you were involved with both seasons? And how did being part of the writer's room, you know, now impact your later life as being a writer, producer, executive producer yourself?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I knew Mark Frost socially. We were friends. And he said, hey, do you want to come to the Directors Guild tonight? They're showing us the screen, the pilot that I did with David Lynch. Well, of course, the answer was yes. I watched the pilot like everybody. I was just stunned. And in the lobby, I can still see it. I walked up to Mark and told him how much I loved the work and said, look, I mean, I've never done television before, but if you need any writers, I can't tell you how much I'd love to work on this show. And back then, there was no writer's room, actually. There were certain writers who worked on the show. Most of them were kind of freelance writers who were brought in. There were a couple of us who were there from, you know, episode to episode. And what you would do routinely is walk in, sit down in Mark's office, and he would walk you through an outline for an episode. You'd discuss the outline. You'd understand that you had the freedom to take big swings and try anything that you thought could make it better. And for me, Mark was already a really experienced writer and a brilliant one, I might add. And so that was sort of like going to school for me. And I did learn a lot about what happened in the future. It was like being there with Mark and seeing the way he worked and seeing the way he told story was just wonderful. But it was, oddly enough, not a writer's room. We didn't even have one. It was just working with Mark from episode to episode. And after I wrote my first one, he read it, and my phone rings at 11:30 at night and said, look, you got to come to the show. And I said, yeah, no problem. I'm in. And that led to a pretty crazy two-year period for us.
How many scripts? You wrote quite a few scripts for Twin Peaks, both seasons.
Yeah, I wrote two. I wrote two of the first seven, and then in the second season, I don't know my name. I mean, we wrote a lot of scripts together, so we'd have like two writers, be Mark and myself, or me and Bob Engels, or whomever. So my name is probably on, I don't know, half, two-thirds of them. I was there quite a bit for both the first and the second season.
Now, 2 years afterward, you got involved in reviving one of the great groundbreaking shows in all of television history, Route 66. For those who don't know, it was really the first television drama that was shot totally on location, with a different location every single episode, whether it was New York, Chicago, the Bayou, New Orleans, Tacoma, Washington State, et cetera, et cetera. It ran for four seasons. And how did you get involved with making that show happen again?
I mean, I'm trying to think what actually led me there. I know Warren Littlefield was then at NBC, and so I think there was a show that they had the rights, and Burt wanted to remake it. So they put us – I think my agent then put me together with Burt, and we talked about it. At that point, I think I'd written the movie Lesson Zero, so there was some feeling like, okay, well, let's kind of use some of that energy in the making of the show. And, you know, listen, it was just a pleasure. I mean, it was not a success. We shot, I think, four episodes that aired, and I feel like it's a missed opportunity. But one of the great things was working with Bert. And he would tell me stories that originally, and what you said is absolutely correct, Sterling Sylvan, who one of the great all-time television writers who created the show, they'd be shooting an episode in, like, Bakersfield. And meanwhile, Sterling is driving around in his car with Bert, trying to find a location that strikes his fancy to write the next episode or an episode a couple down the line. And they go to the Hoover Dam and go, you know what, I'm doing a Hoover Dam episode. And Bert would go, great. And Sterling Sylvan would get his typewriter out and start typing away. And suddenly the whole production would then move on to the next place. Needless to say, that's, as you said, was just groundbreaking. And it's one of the pleasures of watching that show, because you really get a sense of, wow, this is America. This is telling a show about that road and everything along the way. And it was, oddly enough, something we weren't able to do, and we did at NBC. I've pitched this concept since then, I'd say 50 times, because there are places all over America where you could get tax breaks. Atlanta, New Mexico, Detroit, you know, they're all very well known to people who make television. And my idea was always, you can do something like Route 66 and take advantage of the tax breaks and shoot your first season in Atlanta, second season Detroit, third season. Anyway, I haven't managed to get it done yet, but I'm still hopeful.
Well, I'm happy you're still pitching. We should point out that Burt is Herbert B. Leonard, who is really one of the great executive producers in all of television. He did Rin Tin Tin in the 50s and Circus Boy, which was Mickey Dolan's entry in television. And then he did not only Route 66, but Naked City, first half hour with Sterling Sylvan writing most of the scripts, And then the hour-long version ran for three seasons on ABC from 60 to 63. And he did two outstanding series at the same time. And what was it like to work with Herbert B. Leonard? He seemed to have that great voice, by the way, with the famous line, "There are 8 million stories in Naked City. This has been one of them." What was it like to work with him and to get him back into the spirit of doing something like Root, where, again, you have a dedicated production crew, you're going from place to place, you're trying to create a rhythm with the main characters and so on?
Look, I was a young writer. I knew the show very well, but obviously didn't know Bert. And when I finally met him, it was sort of love at first sight. I mean, he was such a classic television old school producer, and he was determined, and he would fight for what he believed in. He was super smart, super creative, and obviously loved working with writers. And his relationship with Silliphant, as you just mentioned, resulted in some pretty wonderful television. And that's because Bert was a producer who really knew how to work with writers. And I didn't get to work with him nearly as much as I would have liked to, but it was a wonderful experience while I did. And just listening to him tell stories, because that's particularly at that age, you want to learn, you want to hear more about shows and how they did the things that they did. And that was one of the kind of wonders of the show, was being able just to hang out with Bert, to have him tell those stories and watch him work, because he was really sort of a legend at that point. And look, he's in the Hall of Fame as far as I'm concerned. The shows you mentioned are the reason. He was a wonderful man and did a lot of great work.
And I had the opportunity to interview him when I was at Broadcast Week at Trade Publication, when he did one of his last shows, the revival of Rin Tin Tin, Canine Cop, for the Family Channel, now Freeform. He just was a marvelous human being. His work with writers and directors, I might add, he had some of the best writers and directors in episodic television on both Naked City and in Route 66. I got to ask,
you bet.
Didn't NBC realize that four episodes is cannot be enough to like establish the characters, establish the mood, get the chemistry going and so forth? Why did the show end up only with four episodes?
That's a great question that I don't have the answer for. It was a very weird circumstance. Understand that we started out shooting what was then called a presentation pilot, which is you're shooting like 20 minutes. You're shooting like a greatest hits. And that was with a completely different cast. And they looked at the 20 minutes. They said, we see something here. We like the story a lot, but let's recast and shoot it again. So then we went again, and I believe Michael Lehman shot the first one, and then Ken Kwapis, who went on to do amazing work, shot the pilot that actually aired. And, you know, it was one of those things where it was they're going to put it on in the summer, but then they weren't, but then they did. It somehow fell between the cracks, I think. The cast was good. You had Dan Cortez and James Wilder, who actually got along great and were really doing some really wonderful work, I thought. But it was unfortunate. They never really had a way to kind of make it happen. And Michael Mann at one point was attached to one of these things. I mean, it's the kind of idea that I would not be surprised if it came back again someday, because it's just such a wonderful way to tell stories. And, you know, like The Fugitive, which is another show, there's the main story, but the real story is America. And it's about meeting these various characters and going through them. And I'm actually sort of surprised that we haven't seen another attempt at doing it, because it wouldn't surprise me at all if it happened.
I hope we do, Harley, because one of the great things about that show was it showcased culture, and it showcased culture in all sorts of places, from Maine to Washington State, to California, to New Mexico, and so forth. And the writing also surprised you sometimes. There were episodes, and you can see them on YouTube, that were really very, very groundbreaking for television, dealt with subject matter or with unique characters that often had stories that did not end happily. And, for example, there was one episode dealt with terrorism where Martin Milner had a double that was a terrorist. Mm-hmm. Oh, boy. And I believe that was one that actually, because of JFK's assassination, was actually delayed in going on CBS.
Yeah.
I would love to see it happen, because there's so much about this culture, about this country, that I think deserves to be showcased. And Route 66 is just a great way. And if you want to see the original episodes, as well as original Naked City episodes, go to YouTube. You will see the brilliant genius of Sterling Philippon and Herbert B. Leonard on Route 66.
Yep.
And Naked City, Howard Rodman, and everybody who worked on that show. And Philippon did a number of the scripts, too, for ABC and that series. And the great thing is, thanks to you two, we can really, really see it. Besides from Reginald, are there any other new shows that you want to do that are in the pipeline?
Not any that I can talk about. I mean, this is what you usually do. So I've got a couple ideas out there that I think could be interesting. But it's you know, like any writer, you're always looking for something. Right now, I think The Rock, we're pushing up a hill, is going for our second season of Reginald. And that's something that you kind of – so then, you know, every week you're talking about ratings and you're talking about promotion and ways to get you to a second season. And listen, we have a complicated production model. We have various partners. But the good news is we're selling really like crazy overseas right now. I think Reginald's a big part of that. And so the overseas sales are really a good sign for us. And the show, as you know, airs on Sci-Fi until December, and then it moves over to Hulu, actually, for a run starting in the spring. So, you know, there's a lot of ways for people to see the show, although they should see it now on Sci-Fi. But that to me is still my prime concern at the moment. While there might be other things I'm out there talking to people about, the main thing I want to do right now is try to get Reginald to that second season, because thanks to Joni Truitt and his 7 books, we have a lot of stories to tell.
If you want to get to that second season, check out the program this Wednesday night, 10 p.m. East Pacific time on Sci-Fi. Check your locals where Sci-Fi is available on cable and satellite in your area. For more details about the show and everything else that Sci-Fi does, including Chucky, check out sci-fi.com. That's SYFY.com. And again, if you want to see the great episodes of Route 66 and Naked City, check out YouTube at youtube.com. Also available on smart TV sets and smart TV devices as well. And I'm sure there may be some Twin Peak episodes somewhere along the line down there, too. Harley Payne, congratulations on getting Reginald off the ground. Congrats, of course, a long time overdue on your Emmy nomination for Twin Peaks. It was well-deserved. It's been a pleasure to have you on, and I hope that we get you back on soon. It's been a delight.
Simon, thank you so much. I had a great time, and I do hope to come back, and I'll bring another show with me if I'm lucky enough.
And I hope one way or another Route 66 does get revived and alone for a longer time. It deserves it now more than ever. Harley, thanks again. Take care. Yep. Have a sensational week.
Thank you. You too, Simon. Bye-bye.
Harley Payton from Reginald the Vampire joining us live from Bainbridge Island, Washington State, near Seattle, in an interview exclusive interview right here on Tomorrow Be Televised. When we come back, we've got News Note Quickies. We have the return of our classic trivia question of the week. And, yes, there are some guests that we hope to have on today, and we need to explain why they're not on. And before the top of the hour, we start celebrating the 50th season of Great Performances with its executive producer since 1979, David Horn. He will join me live from Long Island near the top of the hour. That's all coming up after we pause at the bottom of this hour for web identification. You're listening to the best internet radio on the planet, www.blogtalkradio.com, speaker.com, tune.com, together reaching over 75 million listeners around the world every month and growing. Check out the Mother Love Show. It's on today at 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific. Mother Love, great guest. Check it out. 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific, exclusively on Blog Talk Radio. And remember, that's VTR 24/7 at YouTube.com. Also available on smart TV sets and devices. Welcome back to our second half hour of this 90-minute edition of Tomorrow Be Televised. Simon with you live from New Web, New York. Great to have you with us. If you have a question or comment for our guest ahead, David Horn from Great Performances, give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Coming up, we've got the return of our classic trivia segment. We have 3 prizes in play for the question that we haven't posed in several weeks. We're going to pose it again because we want a winner, and that winner could be you. Easier than Powerball. And I know they got $1.9 was $2 billion. And the actual cash is like nearly $1 billion. Woo! Anyway, easier than done with the question we got for you. So stay tuned because you could be our next trivia winner and win a trio of great, great prizes. But right now, we have a lot of News Note Quickies to get to you. So get them, we will. Fox's version of Fantasy Island will open its second season on January 2nd. Rosalind Sanchez in the Mr. Rourke or Mrs. Rourke role. Another second season opener, Carnival Row on Prime Video, will be the start of a series finale. The first season 2 episode debuts on February 17th. Showtime will offer A Gentleman in Moscow with Ewan McGregor as the gentleman next year. Nuestra TV, the bilingual programming service that started a few months ago, who's one of the key executives on our show this past summer, is now playing on Roku and Amazon Fire Television. Nuestra offers more than 15,000 hours of on-demand content plus a 40-channel bundle. Get ready to say goodbye for good to A Million Little Things on ABC. The network is canceling the slice of life drama after 5 seasons. NBC Universal will keep the Kelly Clarkson show in daytime syndication through 2025. HBO's 4-part Richard Branson docuseries will premiere on December 1st. Former Law & Order co-star Elizabeth Rom, lately directing Lifetime Rojo movies, will get the opportunity to direct at least one upcoming Law & Order episode. How? Being selected in NBC Universal's 2022-23 Landmark Scripted Directors Program. We'll keep you posted on when the former ADA co-star of Law & Order with Sam Worthington will have the opportunity to play director on that very same series. YouTube Shorts, a.k.a. YouTube's response to TikTok, starred this morning on various smart TV sets and devices. Individual shorts run as long as 60 seconds. By the way, TikTok is already running on a number of smart TV sets, devices, and multi-channel bundles. And ITVX, the new British-based mega content venture, is set to launch December 8th. Over 10,000 hours of programming will be available at the start. And that is news notes for today. Well, now it's time for our classic trivia question of the week. It's been a couple of weeks since we have brought you the question. But before we do that, we do have to explain that we originally were going to have a two-hour episode for you, and we were going to have, in addition to Harley Payton and David Horn, who is coming up near the top of the hour, three actually more very special guests. One of them is the person who oversees Hallmark Channel's original holiday movies, the movies that you will be seeing running on Hallmark Channel and Hallmark Movies and Mysteries over the next 2 months. Her name is Samantha DiPippo, and she is Hallmark Media's Senior Vice President of Development. Originally, we advertised last week that she was going to be on this very half hour. Sadly, we learned late last night that she developed a case of coronavirus, and it's a very bad case, sad to say. We are talking with Hallmark's people about having her on at the earliest this Friday, and hopefully, if not, next week. We know that Hallmark Media wanted to have her on. We're very, very sorry about, obviously, her getting coronavirus. We wish her a warp speedy recovery, and we'll keep you posted. We hope, again, to have her on earliest is Friday, hopefully, if not then, sometime next Monday or Friday. Then, at 4:30 Eastern and Pacific time, we were going to end our program today with the two creators and executive producers behind the CBS Sunday night series East New York, which is shot on location in that area of Brooklyn, with a cast including Jimmy Smits and Richard Kind from Spin City and a lot of other very interesting people. The creators and executive producer Mike Flynn and William Finkelstein, if the latter name sounds familiar, he was one of the key writers on L.A. Law for NBC in the late 80s and early 1990s. Well, after our show on Friday, we have the Accidental Wolf writer-director Arian Moyette, who we had on live from Budapest. He is now co-starring in a new Blumhouse production for Prime Video, headed by the Oscar winner from West Side Story, Ariana DeBose. We learned, again, after we did the show, that because of new production schedules, Mike and William could not be on today. CBS was very apologetic. They came to us with the opportunity to have Mike and William on. We are, again, trying to reschedule them, hopefully, for sometime before the end of this month. So once again, if you were expecting Samantha DiPippo this half hour from Hallmark Media, she is dealing with the coronavirus and hopefully on her way to a warp speed recovery. Again, we are talking with Hallmark's people about either having her on this Friday, if she can do it, or if not, next Monday or Friday. And then Mike Flynn and William Finkelstein from East New York, which was on, if you were hoping for 9 o'clock, it actually ended up on 9:40 because of the runover of National Football League games and the 4 p.m. window. So, again, we're going to try to get Mike and William on, hopefully before the end of the month. I had a chance to see some of the episodes, very good episodes. And I'll tell you, if they really have the you're getting a sense that this show is, while it's a police procedural, is finding its chemistry, and they have more ambitions, particularly given the area that they're dealing with, East New York, otherwise known as Ocean Hill, Brownsville area of Brooklyn, an area that is still trying to find itself. It's always been one of the toughest areas in terms of crime in New York City, not to, of course, Brooklyn and all of New York City, but they are trying to get back, like Bushwick has, like Williamsburg has, like Greenpoint has, to really make a name for themselves. And I'm very impressed with what they're doing and how they're doing it. A lot of alumni from Law & Order are involved, and Law & Order SVU are involved in making the show as well, and hopefully we'll have Mike and William on the program before the end of the month. So we just want to take time to let you know why they were not on today, and especially the situation with East New York. We've said it before, and we'll say it again. When you are dealing with a show that is currently in production, you are always at the whims of changes in filming or taping schedules, last-minute story conferences, last-minute film editing, all sorts of things that come across in production. So that was the case, unfortunately, with Mike and William from East New York. And East New York is on 9 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time, or depending on the runover, shortly after because of NFL football, on your local CBS station. For more details, cbs.com. And, of course, check out homeworkchannel.com, homeworkwithmysteries.com for the latest on the upcoming original movie schedule on both of those services. And we will certainly keep you posted on our Facebook and Twitter feeds about what is going on with both of our potential guest segments. All right, now time for our classic trivia question of the week. It's been a couple weeks with my personal health situation, but finally we're making it happen, and we're going to bring back the question that we had. We've got three great prizes in store for you. We've got two books, the new science fiction book, Tune In Tomorrow by Randy Dawn, who was a guest on this program earlier this year, and Dan Harari's wonderful Flirting with Fame, a Hollywood publicist recalls 50 years of celebrity close encounters. Dan was also on this show earlier this year as well. Plus, we have AMC Network's new notepad and notepad case. And they can all be yours if you know the answer to this question. Who was Joe Friday's first partner on the TV version of Dragnet? Who was Joe Friday's first partner on the TV version of Dragnet? We're talking about the original Dragnet television version in the 1950s. And no, it was not Ben Alexander playing his partner for most of that run, Frank Smith. It was someone else. And I'll tell you what, to make it even easier, we will take either the actor's name or the character's name. So the answer could be the character's name or the actor's name. Again, the question, who is Joe Friday's first, that's Jack Webb, first partner on the original TV version, the 1950s version of Dragnet? If you know the answer, email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. That's simonapple04@yahoo.com. Don't forget to enclose your name and where you are emailing from. And if you're first with the correct answer, you will win all three prizes. If we don't get a winner by the end of today, we will post the question tomorrow on Facebook and Twitter. Facebook at Simon Applebaum, Twitter at UBC Simon TWBT. That's Facebook at Simon Applebaum, Twitter at UBC Simon TWBT. And remember, you got to win to be in, so email. By the way, if you have won before or if you're a former guest on the program, you are not eligible. So it's only new folks, new listeners. So make it happen. Email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. It's simonapple04@yahoo.com. Again, enclose your name and where you're emailing from. One more time, here is the question. Who was Joe Friday's original TV partner on the original 1950s TV version of Dragnet? We'll either take the actor's name or the character's name. SimonApple04@yahoo.com. Remember, in order to win, you got to get in. So do so, and all the very best. I want to go back for a moment to one of our news notes at the top of the hour, and it was the news note about Jimmy Kimmel being given the opportunity for a third time by ABC to host the Academy Awards. Number 95, it will be running live on March 12th from the Dolby Theater at Ovation in Hollywood. When Kimmel was quoted in the press release announcing this, here's what he said. And keep in mind the last thing he says. Being invited to host the Oscars for a third time is either a great honor or a trap. Either way, I am grateful to the Academy for asking me so quickly after everyone good, unquote. And that raises to me this question, which I'm going to use to kick off a commentary. Why is it that the main stars of Hollywood, the main stars of motion pictures, whether it's Denzel Washington or Emma Thompson or Anthony Hopkins, or Hugh Jackman, or other people that you know, Kevin Costner. Why aren't they hosting the Academy Awards? Why is it that we're getting TV people hosting, not movie people? Whether it's a newcomer on the scene, or whether it's somebody who's been around for years. Why is it that we are not seeing movie people, like maybe Steven Spielberg, hosting a ceremony dedicated to motion pictures? We've raised this question before, and we're going to raise it again. The whole idea of an award show, whether it's the Oscars, the Emmys, the Tonys, the Grammys, is all about, when you boil it all down, two things. You are honoring the art, and you are encouraging people to see the art. And that is what has not happened with the Oscars in the last decade, or the Grammy Awards in the last couple of years, or the Emmy Awards in the last couple of years. Why? Very simple. Because the audience in the room, to the people doing the show, is more important than the audience out there, the you and me's all over the country that are tuning in on ABC, or in the case of the Emmy Awards, whatever network is running it, or in the case of the Grammy Awards, CBS. And yes, I know the slap was a big problem last year with Will Smith and Chris Rock. But the bigger issue to me, and why the ratings have gone down, 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 to the point where less than 10 million people are watching some of these award shows. Less, in the case of the Oscars, 2 years ago, it was almost less than 10 million people. Yes, it did raise it to like 12, 13 million watching it live, but it left a lot of people with a bad taste. And it wasn't just because of the slap. It's because of the whole attitude of the Oscars. It is, well, let's give the viewers jokes that fly over their head. Let's give them inside baseball. Let's political posturing. Let's do diatribes. Let's make our deal a soapbox of whatever or for whatever. And what to me, and I believe to the general public at large, that's not what they are tuning in for. They are tuning in to celebrate an art. They are tuning in to be encouraged to see the art. They don't get encouraged when jokes happen that frankly are over their heads. They're not honoring or being encouraged to sample the art where actors act like crazy. Like 2 years ago when Frances McDormand was doing the Wolf Hounds, the Wolf Sounds, all of a sudden. You notice that Nomadland, which, you know, won McDormand the Oscar, you notice how it has faded into memory? I'll bet you because of the Oscars. That ceremony. Screw that film up. People do not want to be talked down to. They want to be empowered. They want to be engaged. You don't engage people by telling jokes that have political elements to it, or inside baseball, or doing stupid things like a coronavirus test in front of an audience that wasn't funny. And people and actors acting stupid. Like, for example, a James Bond salute that was having an extreme sports star introduce it and doing a film tribute to James Bond with a rap soundtrack. Or doing an in memoriam segment that consistently loses key people. When you have Turner Classic Movies every year doing their annual TCM Remembers, and they have no problem with it. Because it's comprehensive, because it hits the mood, it hits the spot, and the audience can get it. I really believe that this is 2023, edition number 95, is the last shot that ABC has to make the Academy Awards work. If they blow this, it ain't going to be on ABC for far too long. If they go under 10 million viewers, and this time it sticks, this show is going somewhere else. Maybe on Hulu, maybe on Netflix, maybe Amazon, somewhere else. But it won't be on ABC. And the Emmys and the Grammys and the Tonys had better take that into account. The woke era has got to come to an end. The political soapboxing has got to come to an end. And Jimmy Kimmel has to realize this. And it's not just him. It's everybody involved with the Motion Picture Academy of PV Arts and Sciences. One more thing. Again, the technical categories, I hate to say this to the Oscars, people do not care about sound mixing. People do not care about makeup. They do care about cinematography and film editing and visual effects. How do you do it? You give those events live, give those categories live, and everything else, you do a five-minute recap on the air. You give out the awards earlier on, you do a five-minute recap on the air, you give them a chance to say something, that's that. But you got to start thinking about the viewer, folks. TV, Motion Picture Academy, you must start thinking about the viewer, not about yourselves. And ABC, that goes for you too. Luckily, you have two marvelous award producers, the folks who do the Tonys every year, and they've done the Oscars, Glenn Weiss and Ricky Kirshner. I think they'll turn it around. I really do. I have hope that they will. And they've got to put their foot down. And ABC, you must supervise this. You must put your foot down. This has to be a three-hour show that ends at 11 o'clock. Starts at 8, ends at 11. That's it. And if it means you got to cut some things out, you do it. This is the last time, Oscars. Make it good. Really, make it good. And I'd love to hear what you think about this. Email me, call me, 646-652-2906. Use the chat room, SimonApple04 by name, or find me on social media at LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter. Respond to what you have to say, because what you say matters now more than ever before. In a few moments, we'll be joined by David Horn, the executive producer of Great Performances, now in the midst of its 50th season. It's hard to believe that 1972, one of the greatest, best efforts of public television, started 50 years ago this very autumn. And David will join us live from Long Island in a matter of moments. I want to remind you that we are here, in case you're with us. This is the show about TV's current and future. We're with you Mondays and Fridays, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, here on Blog Talk Radio, Speaker Tune, and Radio. Remember, if you come in late on the program, want to catch up an episode you missed, you can go to our homepage. A few minutes after we go off the air, we put the show on there. It's blogtalkradio.com/televised, blogtalkradio.com/televised. You can also check us out on a lot of different podcast destinations. We're on Spotify, iTunes, iHeartRadio's Podcast Network, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Podvine.com, Verbal, many, many others. And if your favorite podcast, I think, doesn't take our show, let them know, let me know. We'll get into a conversation, and we'll resolve that matter as quickly as possible. And don't forget, we also have a website that you can check us out on anytime you like. It's tomorrowwillbetelevised.onpodium.com. It's tomorrowwillbetelevised, hyphens between the words, .onpodium.com. And guess what? We also have a special question box. So if you have a question about television, about yours truly, and our comments and our guests and so forth, put your question in that box. I'll look at it, and if we address it on the air, of course you get the credit. That's tomorrowwillbetelevised.onpodium.com. And we really appreciate what you have to say. As we say usually at the end of every show, we really, really, really want you to respond. We want you to be as interactive with us. So do check us out. It does make a difference in our show, and we love having you aboard. So don't forget, it's simonapple04@yahoo.com. You can also find me on Twitter at UBC Simon, TWBT, and also LinkedIn and Facebook at Simon Applebaum. It's as easy as that. I do respond to your social media and emails within 24 hours because, as we say all the time, what you say matters now more than ever. And coming up Friday on Tomorrow Be Televised, among our guests, we will have someone who's worked with the likes of David E. Kelly, who's trying to get her own series on the air somewhere. It's called Middlehood. She is creator producer Michelle Palermo. She actually showed the first two episodes at Series Fest a couple of years ago. at the Denver-based TV Programming Fair. And thanks to that and a Kickstarter campaign, she's actually been made, able to make the entire 10-episode first season. Now it's a matter of finding a home for the program. Michelle Palermo from Middlehood shall be one of our guests this Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. So do check us out and be involved in the program. The more interactive you are, the better it is. Incidentally, if we have time in our final half hour, we will repeat the classic trivia question. And because we are on the day before Election Day, we have a special tradition that we do around here, and that is encouraging you to exercise your right to vote tomorrow. So we'll have that special commentary toward the end of our program in our next half hour. All righty. We are awaiting David Horn, the executive producer of Great Performances. He should be joining us in a matter of moments. While we're waiting, let me tell you about Great Performances and about a wonderful relationship we've had with public television, a very special relationship. Over the course of our 15 years doing this program, we have a number of times saluted anniversaries for some of the longest-running shows on public television, like the 50th anniversary of Sesame Street, the 40th anniversary of Nature, a big anniversary for Masterpiece Theater, and other long-running shows. It's amazing to believe that 50 years ago this fall, a new series premiered on public television stations called Great Performances. It originally had three distinct elements: Theater in America, Dance in America, and Music in America. Well, over the course of the last half century, more than 1,000 episodes have been made of Great Performances, and it has presented a wide variety of incredible talent, past and present. And throughout, there have only been two executive producers behind the series. One was the late, great entrepreneur Jacques Benza, who originally started his career as a set designer at WCBS-TV here in New York. In fact, one of his programs, the Sunday morning show I used to watch a lot called Around the Corner. It was a kid's show. It was on, ran for several years with a wonderful hostess named Molly Scott. The second started his Great Performances career in 1979, and he joins us right now live from Long Island, New York. In an interview exclusive, the executive producer of Great Performances, now a half century old on PBS, now on Fridays on most PBS stations at 9:10 Pacific time, David Horn. David, congratulations. Welcome back to our program.
Hey, Simon, it's great to be on your show again. You make me sound so old, though.
No way, no way, and no how. Can you believe it, David, 50 years of a program like this?
Well, it's really been the only place you can really find full-length performances, no matter what genre you're interested in. Networks gave it up a long time ago, so we feel like we provide quite a service, particularly to people that can't afford to go to theater, concert, dance shows, and those that live too far away from places where they can actually see them live. So it's been a fun ride. That's all I can say.
And in a moment, we're going to get into that fun ride in general. We are joined by David Horn, the executive producer of Great Performances. It's on most PBS stations, including WAT here in New York, Friday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern Pacific time, and we'll find out about how Great Performances evolved over this half century and what they've got coming for this season 50. David Horn joins us from Long Island, and we'll get back to him plus more after we pause near the top of the hour for web identification. This is the best internet radio on the planet, www.blogtalkradio.com, speaker.com, tune.com, together reaching over 75 million listeners around the world every month and growing. Check out The Jazz Mill, one of the few radio shows of its kind about this great American art form. The Jazz Mill, Wednesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific. That's 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, right here on Blog Talk Radio. And remember, BTR is now available on YouTube, which is now available on more smart TV sets and smart TV devices than ever. Welcome back to our final half hour of Tomorrow Be Televised. Simon Abbaum with you live from New York. And I'm joined live from Long Island by David Horn, the executive producer of Great Performances, this year marking a half century on the air through public television. If you have a question or comment for our guest, make that phone call, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. The number is good anyway. You're catching us across the country, around the globe. You're on Blog Talk Radio, Speaker, and TuneIn Radio. Don't forget, we've got our chat room, available for you right now. It's SimonApple04. You will find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. And we want to welcome those of you who just joined us at the top of the hour. And remember, while the promo is on the air, you can connect us using Facebook Timeline. It's on the Facebook icon of Blog Talk Radio, speaker tune, screen, follow the instructions, and other people live with you. David, how has Great Performance evolved over this half century? I mentioned before you came on, it originally started as sort of three miniseries under an umbrella, Theater in America, Dance in America, and Music in America. How did you get on the air in the first place?
Well, it got on the air in the first place because originally it was Theater in America, and Theater in America was part of the old National Educational Television station in New York, and primarily focused on plays. And then when the series merged, it was with the help of Exxon, who was a big supporter of music, and the National Endowment for the Arts. It was very interested in ballet, and that's how we began the Dance in America portion of Great Performances. It, in the early days, primarily focused on bringing studio productions of most of the works of George Balanchine to the stage. But then we've figured that, you know, there's a lot more performing arts out there that we weren't paying a lot of attention to, particularly music theater, a lot of popular artists like Bocelli, crossover artists like Bocelli, Josh Groban, Michael Bublé, David Foster, Tony Bennett and Lady Gaga, Sting, Billy Joel. We could just go on forever with all the pop artists that felt like they could stretch out a little bit further than they could in the more commercial broadcast networks. And then we made a tremendous commitment in drama to Shakespeare, originally broadcasting most of the plays back in the late 70s and the 80s. And since then we've had, you know, we've had Kevin Klein, we've had Jeremy Irons, Patrick Stewart, Ian McKellen, and a lot of great up-and-coming Shakespearean actors as well. And that's been, you know, it's not only been one of our hallmarks, we're going to capitalize on our devotion to Shakespeare this fall when we celebrate the 400th anniversary of the publishing of Shakespeare's first folio.
As a matter of fact, David, one of your first shows in this 50th season is called Black Lucy and the Bard, and it does deal with Shakespeare, but from a dance perspective, with an organization a lot of people don't know about, the Nashville Ballet, which has really become one of the major companies in the country.
It was really an interesting project because it was all based on a book by Carolyn Randall Williams, a black Nashville poet who was digging into the rumors, the lore, that the dark lady in the Shakespeare sonnets was really this black woman who ran a brothel in London. And so she worked together with Paul Vasterling, who's the artistic director and head choreographer of the Nashville Ballet, and they decided to bring in Rhiannon Giddens to do the music. And it's not kind of a combination of roots music and, you know, late 16th, early 17th century forms of music as well. And it really tells, it's, you know, not only is the, has the writer written the story, but she performs on the stage. She actually interacts with the dancers. So it's funny that I didn't think about that when I was mentioning all the Shakespeare, but there you have kicking off and kind of finishing this 50th anniversary season with two unique Shakespearean projects.
Mm-hmm. Talk about Jacques Venza, the original executive producer of Great Performances, and how did he make the contribution that he did to the series in its early years?
Well, Jack is retired in Florida, living a good life, but Jack started his career as a designer in the 50s, and mostly for CBS. He actually worked on Judy Garland show, many things like that. And he had a passion for dance. And he like, in the early days of public television, a lot of the pioneers are people that came over from network to be able to do different things, to be able to, you know, do less commercial television. But, you know, it wasn't easy. You have to, you know, one of the biggest challenges in public television is finding the funding. you know, being able to sell these ideas to not just one, you know, funder that writes a check. You need many different funders. You need a lot of support. And a lot of the types of shows that we do take a lot of development. So you have to have funding into the future as well. To, you know, Jack was quite a visionary and remains one. I was lucky to work for Jack. He taught me a lot.
One of the early highlights of Great Performance, in addition to Theater in America, was Dance in America. And I had the opportunity later on to interview Meryl Brockway, the brilliant producer director of Camera 3 during its run on CBS, who was one of the really the director of Dance in America. The executive was Emil Ardolino. A lot of people know him as the director of Dirty Dancing. Dance in America really was a pioneering effort. It was like a pioneering effort within Great Performances because it was the first time that dance had been presented on a regular basis from some of the great companies, whether it was New York City Ballet, American Ballet Theater, Joffrey Ballet, I believe, was the opening episode with Trinity, which I think is one of the great dances of all time. I love the Trinity Leap that Gary Crist, one of my favorite ballet dancers ever, did. And I saw that when I was at American University in Washington, D.C., I actually saw a performance of Trinity live by the Joffrey Ballet. It was my first Kennedy Center performance, and it was brilliant. But Meryl and Emil really brought, I think, a sense of how you make the cameras work for dance, whether it is, no matter what the dance company was.
There was a very specific style to shooting dance, you know, where you had to retain the complete figures on stage. But, you know, how the directors, Meryl and Emil, worked specifically with the choreographers, like, to actually maybe re-block some of the things so they would work better for camera. And, you know, that took a lot of convincing. You know, people like Balanchine were certainly skeptical. And then there were people like Twyla Tharp that really embraced it, and so did Jerry Robbins, to the point where Jerry Robbins wanted to actually do the videotape editing of the dance pieces that were shot by Great Performances.
How did you get into the executive producer role?
Well, the famous old story is I started out as a jazz musician, and I was doing television kind of part-time to help pay the bill because nobody makes any money playing jazz. And the more and more I got involved with some of these great artists, the less and less music I was actually performing. So we had three different departments for years. We had a drama department, a dance department, and we had a music department. So I was around long enough to work my way up in the mid-'80s to run the music department, and I was able to bring more popular forms of music, a lot more jazz, because that was a favorite of mine, and the Great Performances. And then ultimately I started directing multi-camera shows myself and some documentaries. And Jack was someone who was very encouraging for me to do that. And, you know, after several years, Jack decided he was going to retire, and he wanted me to take over because most of the performances that were on Great Performances on a yearly basis had to do with music. So I was doing the majority of the programs anyway. So I really thank Jack for giving me this opportunity, and I hope he thinks that I've actually grown the series a little bit, maybe created some different types of programs that we hadn't thought of, or, you know, brought back an emphasis on drama via Shakespeare.
We're celebrating the 50th season of Great Performances, which on many public television stations is on Friday night at 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific time. Remember, when we talk about public television, you have to check your local listings not only for the station that runs on, but also when it's played. Some public television stations do not run it at the regular time. They delay it one way or the other, backward or forward. And some also have a second replay during the weekend. So you got to check your local listings again. And also pbs.org for where the show runs. And by the way, Great Performances also runs on the PBS video app, which is available on smart TV sets and smart TV devices as well. Executive producer David Horn is our special guest this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised. Simon Outbound with you live from New York. We are both in the New York metro area. He in Long Island, yours truly in Brooklyn. It is now 74 degrees at the top of the hour. And we want to hear from you. Give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. How many performance episodes do you budget for each year, and how long does it take for, let's say, a specific episode dealing with an artist or a performance or a theme to go from idea to being on the air?
Well, we average about 15. If you count in the Met, we do an additional 11 shows from the Met, but those are generally, other than two primetime shows, those are generally run on Sunday afternoons. Generally, the way great performances has always worked, and this was something I learned from Jack, is you have to treat the artist the way you would treat any star on any network or feature film. Usually an artist comes to great performances because they want to do something unique and special on. Take, for example, an artist like Sting. You know, we did have Sting's popular music, his last concert with the Police on Great Performances, but he did so many other things. You know, he did Renaissance music on Great Performances. He did Northern England folk music on Great Performances. He's doing a show that's going to air late next fall. It's called Message in a Bottle, and it uses all his music to create a new ballet that's all about the refugee experience. And the music really works well in telling a story. So, you know, generally it's an idea, and then it's to figure out how to do it, you know, what it's going to cost and how we're going to pay for it, because we start out each season of Great Performances with about half of the money we need to make the series. So we need a lot of partnerships. We need additional fundraising. And it's a challenge.
Is there a competition among theater or dance companies or musical artists to get on Great Performances? Like, you know, we've got this. You get a lot of suggestions from companies around the country or organizations saying, we have this wonderful performance. We have this unique take on a classic piece of literature, or we have this new avant-garde work, and we'd like to, or we want to spotlight this new composer, and we want to bring that to your attention.
Simon, that happens all the time. You know, we have enough history with a lot of the great regional companies, both ballet, opera, and symphonic companies, that people reach out to us all the time. Unfortunately, we only have so many shows we can do a year, and a lot of times it gets, you know, this is boring, but it gets down to the practical reality of what we think we can raise the money for. There's just a few, you know, like the Lucy and the Bard program, which was just such a unique idea that we had to figure out how to raise the money ourselves to do that show from soup to nuts. But, you know, there are a lot of great ideas out there, and I wish even more people would come after us with ideas, because you just never know. You know, it's like the who would have thunk of this idea of Black Lucy and the Bard and it being a dance show. So, you know, you can't get out. I have to get out and see a lot of shows. You know, we have a big emphasis on Broadway productions now, so I'm, you know, seeing at least one or two Broadway shows a week. So they tend to be an expensive challenge for us, but it's one of the most popular strands of programming that we do.
And incidentally, I want to take a moment to acknowledge all of the foundations and corporations, past and present, that have funded Great Performances over the course of its 50 years. Currently, some of the funders include the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, the Anna Marie and Stephen Kellen Arts Fund, the Lou Esther T. Mertz Charitable Trust, Sue and Edgar Watson's Time III, and many, many others that are involved in either the series as a whole or individual episodes. Something else that's very distinctive about your show is the fact that your theme is by one of the greats, John Williams. Has he ever thought about doing a show for Great Performances?
been on quite a few times. He last time he was on, well, first, you know, it was an honor when he agreed to do our theme. But the last show John did is he wrote a violin concerto for Anne-Sophie Mutter. It was last summer during, you know, COVID, was performed at the Tanglewood, and that was our last program with him. We've had programs with him that have emanated from the Disney Hall at Los Angeles Philharmonic. But John's just, he's just one of the greatest gentlemen in the business. And such an interesting composer. He writes some very difficult, serious music to play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's, to me, he is the gold standard of both TV and film music. And one of these days, I hope somebody will do, and I think great points, it would be great if you did this, David. Somebody needs to do a concert where he just plays all his television music. His themes for shows like Bob Hope Presents the Chrysler Theater and all the scores he did for that show, Checkmate, The Time Tunnel, you know, the science fiction set Lost in Space and so on and so forth. He did a lot of great TV music. Heidi, which he won his first Emmy Award for, Jane Eyre. Somebody needs to do an episode of someplace that's just his television music because it is, he's one of the greats. And
well, Simon, I'd like to have a show where he plays jazz piano trio.
Yeah.
That goes back to
that's
the
how I got started in television, as a matter of fact, was as a jazz pianist.
That's right.
He was involved in a show for Universal with John Cassavetes called Johnny Staccato. Elmer Bernstein wrote the music for that show, which is brilliant. And he was in the band. So you could see him here and there with Cassavetes on piano or another thing. I think Williams played something else. But he was part of that show, and that led to Checkmate, which was his first original. He had done other scores for individual episodes of shows like Wagon Train, but that was the first. Checkmate was his first series thing, and he did a great job with that score.
Well, you sound like a great fan.
I am. I'm a big fan of TV and film music, and I think that particularly with TV music, with the greats like Williams, Elmer Bernstein, Bernard Herrmann, Jerry Goldsmith. People should hear more of their TV music. David Raskin, they wrote some of the great TV music that frankly deserves to be, and I'm happy that YouTube by Nelson Riddle, that they give them an opportunity to hear their music from their episodes the way it was in pristine black and white or color. All about that. David Horn is our guest this half hour. The executive producer of Great Performance is now in his 50th season, and tomorrow we'll talk about some of the shows coming up, and there are some big ones. So stay tuned and give us a call in our remaining minutes with David, 646-652-2906, or use the chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. You've had some very interesting shows so far. For example, the reopening of David Geffen Hall. Has David Geffen Hall reopened yet, or is that still
yes.
in the works?
Our program opened on Friday night. And, you know, anytime you know, this is probably about the third or fourth opening hall program that we've done over the course of my tenure, and it's always a crapshoot. You never know how it's going to work, but you know, the acousticians have become so sophisticated and they can do so much tuning that the you know, a few simple things that they did really enhance the sound there. I mean, television, it's always a secondary experience, you know, because we artificially interpret the sound, but you know, if you have a chance to get there, the hall sounds really great. And one of the improvements is that now they can have popular music concerts, amplified music concerts in there, which was very difficult in the old hall because the, you know, the sound was just terrible. So that was a very successful show. We have a lot of streams, and if you didn't get a chance to see it, you can stream it at pbs.org.
And they use the PBS video app, which is available on smart sets and smart TV devices. You got another big one coming up on November 25th, and that's Josh Groban, who did his Ready to See Music Hall show with the likes of Cyndi Lauper and other terrific guests.
Yeah, Josh holds a place near and dear to me because I directed his first television show back around 2001 and did a couple others since. And this was Josh's coming out party from COVID. And Josh has a lot of guests on the show. He has Cyndi Lauper and Danae Benton. who was with him on Broadway. He has Tyler Peck, who's a dancer with the New York City Ballet. And he does a lot of his hits and a lot of new things. And, you know, it's just nice to be in it after COVID practically shut us down, where we were doing things remotely for a couple of years, that we're out able to do shows again in front of a live audience. So exciting to have Josh back on Great Performances.
Now, you have a lot of very interesting things coming up in season 50. You have a documentary dealing with Kathleen Battle and Jesse Norman, who did a wonderful concept spirituals in Carnegie Hall back in 1990. You've got the Vienna Great Performance is now responsible for the two Vienna Philharmonic New Year's Eve and the or New Year's Day, as well as the summer performances, which include the Vienna State Ballet doing their thing as well. And you have a couple of very interesting projects. Let's talk about Remember This. I think it's a brand new play and one that takes a very interesting spin on the Holocaust.
Well, it's a play by a one-man play by Clark Young and Derek Goldman, and it stars David Strathairn, who gives an incredible performance as Jan Karski. And, you know, Jan Karski, he was not Jewish, but he was a hero, a very reluctant hero, because he was able to witness the Holocaust. And he survived a lot of the camps, trying to get in and find more information. And he was able to gain access to Churchill and Roosevelt, and was trying to convince them of the atrocities that were going on. So it's an incredibly powerful play, beautifully shot. It's a little bit different. It's a little more film-like than a normal stage play that we would capture in front of a live audience. So it's just an outstanding performance. And I think that it's going to air in April.
In addition, you mentioned earlier about the Live from the Met, or the Great Performance at the Met series, which is a separate series from Great Performances. But you also, in recent years, launched a program. I think some might want to call it like the Leonard Bernstein Young People's Concerts of our generation, called Now Hear This, with a man by the name of Scott Yu, who is sort of becoming like, you know, our Leonard Bernstein for television.
Well, it's interesting, you know, that you have that take on it, because the original idea of the show, and this was pre-pandemic, and we were able to get a few shows on air pre-pandemic from the series. The original idea was sort of a Anthony Bourdain version of music, where there'd be some travelogue in it, there'd be food, and there'd be some sort of discovery based around a composer. And a lot of the, you know, Bach, Beethoven, you know, the composers you would normally think of. But this year we're doing, you know, the themes have stretched out a little bit. There's a show on Schumann. It's called Genius and Madness. And it kind of, you know, investigates how close sometimes being a little bit crazy is between being an actual genius. There's an Albanese Portraits of Spain program. We're going down to South America to do a show on tango and Piazzolla's music. And we've got a new composer, a guy named Andy Akiho, who basically makes music with sound instruments. He's a virtuoso steel drum player. So he mixes all these different sources, you know, and basically his roots in lower Manhattan and Brooklyn, to come up with a, you know, because most modern composers these days, I think the big sin they feel is to be derivative. So part of not being derivative is coming up with new instruments and blending them to create kind of a new sound. So that'll be the finale from this year's four episodes of Now Hear This.
Mm-hmm. Two final questions for you, David. One, when will you have the 50th anniversary celebration? And two, in this era of fast channels, where we're seeing all these channels being created for smart TV sets and smart devices, have any talk about maybe doing a Great Performances channel that would run separately from the PBS video app on smart TV sets and devices, and might even be an opportunity to get additional underwriting?
Well, we're always discussing it. You know, there are fast channels coming out of WNET, which is where I work in New York City, which is the home base for American Masters, Nature, and great performances. But we're always the last ones to come in because our shows are so rights intensive. We have a lot of different unions, creative unions, performing arts unions. You know, we have to figure out a way to fund it. You know, and in the early days of fast channels, there's probably not enough revenue at this point, but, you know, it's an aspiration of ours, and as is the whole digital transformation, trying to expand on not only what we do for broadcast and live streaming, but digitally to support and be able to provide more outreach to our programs and make, you know, more artists a part of great performances and accessible to consumers of digital technology across the country.
And the 50th anniversary, when is that going to be? How far are you along on that? When is that going to run?
Well, we're in the early stages of developing it, and I can't really tell you a lot about it, but all I can tell you is it's going to be a Broadway-themed show, and it's going to tape at the David Koch Theater in March and going to be on the air in May, so we're just starting to assemble our creative team and starting to reach out for talent. 10 years ago, I did a 40th anniversary celebration, and that one had artists from all the different genres and a lot of clips from the different genres we did. We had Julie Andrews, and she was doing music theater. We had Michael Bublé, who was doing the Great American Songbook. We had representatives of the City Ballet. So I didn't want to do that show again. And we've made such a huge investment in time and money in Broadway that I want to amplify that. So what it does is what will make it a little bit more different and reflective of great performances is that we'll have performers from a lot of different genres performing Broadway music, because I think everybody has a favorite Broadway song.
For sure. David, thank you very, very much for coming on the program and having us celebrate the 50th year of Great Performance. It's been marvelous. Don't forget, Great Performance is Friday night on most public television stations from WAT here in New York, 9 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time. For more details, pbs.org. Check out the PBS video app as well. See recent episodes on smart TV sets and devices. David, thank you again for being with us. All the greatest to you and everybody on your team for a wonderful season 50 and many, many more.
Simon, thank you for having me again. Hope to do it again soon.
Let's do it for sure. Take care. Have a fantastic week.
All right, you too. So long.
Thank you again to David and to Holly Payne for being with us. The views expressed in this program are those of the participants, not those of the Block Talk Radio, the distributors of this program. Andy Toad, B-Charge, General Manager, Jay Steinberg, Head of Content. With Marvin Televised, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for your listening. Have a great rest of your week. We're back on Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific. You know where, Block Talk Radio speaker or tune in radio. Whatever you're doing between now and then, please make it safe. And remember, tomorrow is election day. Exercise your right to vote. Don't be a bystander. Vote, whatever your political preference is. Remember, there are people who are fighting and dying for the right that you can exercise tomorrow. They don't have it. You do. Exercise it. And then see your vote count. Until the next time, stay well and stay tuned.